Eileen Tracy Race versus George Paul Smith. Kevin Todd Butler is here for the appellate. Jeffrey Slanker is here for the appellees. Mr. Butler, you may begin when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Kevin Butler, and I represent Ms. Race, mother of Ashley Seyfried, and next kin of Ms. Seyfried's minor daughters. There's one central fact in this case that is so obvious that failure to notice it is going to have a serious impact on the public's perception of fairness and integrity in the judicial process itself. The central fact is that Ashley Seyfried was seriously ill with endocarditis when she was brought to the Bradford County Jail and put in the care of Nurse Starr and Sergeant Googe. She was literally deathly ill when she was brought to jail, and she needed to be in the hospital then. She did not need to be in the jail. And when Nurse Starr finally let her see the doctor almost 2 weeks later, the doctor sent her to the hospital. By that time, it was too late. She was an organ failure, she was intubated, she was dying. And what I'm here today is to ask for relief from Nurse Starr and Sergeant Googe's malicious and intentional disparagement and smearing of her character, both in jail and at trial, in violation of the court's order in limine that excluded circumstances surrounding Ms. Seyfried's arrest.
Well, let me tell you the concern that I have. She did not prevail at trial.
She did not.
And we've got a lot of issues here. We got seven issues. And with regard to all of the issues, except for, evidence regarding her prior drug use, it doesn't seem that there was any contemporaneous objection raised to the errors that you allege the court committed.
Well,
no contemporaneous objection.
Your Honor, with respect to the order in limine, the order in limine was definite and clear, and the trial judge in his order.
Yeah, I'm not talking about that, because there was a motion in limine. I'm talking about all the other, the testimony of Alexander Steiner and the evidence during the closing argument and, misstatement of law concerning damages to the jury and the evidence with regard to Sergeant Good as a witness. I mean, there's no contemporaneous objection to any of that.
Your Honor, the whole strategy of the defense in this case was to disparage the character of this woman who was dying in jail. Mm-hmm. That was the whole goal of it. The whole focus of their defense, and all of the basis of the appeal that are stated, that fact is included, or it becomes a part of all of those. And the trial counsel was in a position where, right from the very beginning of the defendant's opening argument, right from the very beginning, they launched right into a violation of the order in limine, the definitive order in limine. And that characterized, that set the tone for the whole trial. And it put the put the plaintiff in the position of having to make the decision of, do I object and call attention again and again to these violations or to this fact that's a harmful and prejudicial fact that the trial judge had said in his order in limine. It's highly prejudicial, and it's highly prejudicial because on the one hand it was not relevant. He said in his order it's not relevant at all. Because the question was not what caused her endocarditis. That was never the question in the case.
As I understand your argument, it's the evidence was relevant. It's just it was prejudicial under Rule 403. Is that?
No, sir.
Your argument is that it's not relevant?
It was not relevant, and the judge said that it was not relevant. He said that it was not relevant, and under Rule 103, he has an affirmative duty to conduct the trial in a manner mm-hmm. uh, that that irrelevant evidence is not admitted to the, not admitted in front of the jury.
So you filed, your client filed a motion in limine seeking to exclude evidence relating to intravenous drug use, but the district court denied the motion, concluding that Ms. Seyfried's IV drug use is relevant and significant to much of the evidence that will be adduced at trial, because the defendants argued it was the cause of the endocarditis and the reason the hospital declined to give her a second mitral valve replacement.
Well, the motion to exclude evidence of the IV drug use, that was granted, but the judge did state in the footnote, he said that it shouldn't be, it's not admissible for every issue.
Right, but it is in fact relevant because it is the reason why she had the endocarditis. It is the reason why she was the hospital denied the only treatment that was going to save her was going to be a second mitral valve replacement, and the hospital denied it because she continued to use drugs after the first mitral valve replacement.
There's never been any dispute that IV drug use probably caused the endocarditis. There was no firm evidence other than the continued reference to. There was no firm and conclusive evidence that IV drug use is what caused the second incident. I mean, it's probably the case, but and it was never disputed. The cause of the endocarditis was never disputed. It never really was put into issue, and it never was challenged. But the way they brought evidence of the drug abuse in was to disparage her character, because that's what was going on. When
so every time they did that during the trial, you should have stood up and objected. Object, Your Honor. They're going beyond your order on the motion in limine. This is, they can put on evidence that the drug use caused her death, but what they're doing is you should rule against her because she's a drug addict. And there was a lot of evidence to that effect. And every time there was evidence to that effect, you should have stood up and objected.
But it was always built around the circumstances of the arrest. The objectionable use of IV drug use, the objectionable use of evidence of IV drug use in the trial was always centered around the circumstances of the arrest. We go through this about seven or eight spots in the record, and each time it was centered around the IV.
So your argument is that my motion in limine covered that, so I didn't need to stand up and object because my motion in limine constituted my objection. It was a standing objection. That's your argument.
A definitive motion in limine is a standing objection.
Counsel, a motion in limine is always tentative. It's pretrial and it's tentative because you don't know how the trial's going to unfold. And so what may appear to be inadmissible prior to trial becomes admissible. So you can't just plain stand, in my view, just stand on a motion to in limine, which is tentative. You know what I mean by that?
I understand.
It's provisional.
I understand, Your Honor, but didn't the
Supreme Court of the United States says that?
But isn't that what the 2000 amendments to Rule 103 meant, 103B? When there is a definitive order on an evidentiary ruling. Once you've got that definitive order, you don't have to preserve that after that. It's there. You don't have to proffer evidence in order to say that you should be able to bring it in, and you don't have to object to it to be able to to keep it out. And the problem with standing up and objecting, once you've got that, is that every time you stand up and object, listen, trial lawyers know that.
There was testimony, was there not, that she had drugs in her system the day she died.
Judge, that's not true. That is not, it was.
Didn't the doctor say she had opioids in her system?
Dr. Stemmer tried to get, he put that into evidence. He put that into evidence, but It was in his testimony, but then he was impeached about that. He was impeached about that and had to draw that, take that back at trial when he said that, no, I was wrong about that. She did not have drugs in her system when she was, she didn't take drugs in jail. She was clean when she went to the hospital. When she went to the hospital, when they finally let her go to the hospital, she was clean. So, in short, yes, I'm understanding that there's this problem with not objecting. I understand that. But trial counsel know that...
We wrote an opinion which says, district judges, you make a provisional ruling on an evidentiary issue prior to trial, and we're going to, without contemporaneous objections going on during the trial, we're going to reverse a judgment.
I'm not sure I understood the question, Your Honor.
Well, you can't have a model in which you say to the district judge, make a tentative ruling. By definition, it's a tentative ruling. The Supreme Court of the United States says a ruling in limine is provisional. And so if we say to district judges, if you make a tentative ruling prior to trial, and it turns out the evidence is admissible, and there's no objection, we're still going to reverse the judgment.
But
on the ground that the objection was preserved over and over and over again, and you committed plain error.
My understanding of Rule 103B is that, and my understanding of that rule of that rule of evidence is that when it's a definitive ruling, it's not tentative. It's not tentative. Now, if that's the case, then I would say that order would need to be specifically withdrawn, and the court would need to let us know at trial that, listen, I have withdrawn this motion in limine, and it's not binding anymore. That didn't happen either.
But you're also arguing that the other side exceeded the scope of the trial court's ruling, and were using it for different purposes, and there was no objection made that preserved that issue.
But there was no way to object to that.
Because, sure, well, there is.
The problem with objecting to it, though, is every time you stand up and object to it, you're calling a jury's attention back to it.
Well, that's a strategic decision, but there you are running into a waiver problem.
I'm way past my time, but the purpose of the... The purpose of the motion in limine is so that the trial counsel is not put upon to have to make that strategic decision with respect to evidence that just absolutely should not come in, and the judge has already ruled that way.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Butler, we'll hear from Mr. Slanker.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Jeff Slanker. I'm here with my law partner, Michael Spellman. I have the pleasure of representing the appellees in this case today, Mr. Starr and Sergeant Gooch. My friend, Mr. Butler, on the other side, made a remark. He said that standing up and objecting, that's a decision for trial counsel to make. Juries might perceive counsel to be obstreperous. Well, trial lawyers know that through the course of here, a five-day trial, you make thousands of strategy decisions on a split second, whether or not to object to something, whether or not to let something in, whether or not to move for mistrial, what type of request for a curative instruction you're going to make. But the point of the contemporaneous objection rule is to put these issues before the trial court, to allow the trial court to make a decision and to correct any error within his discretion, to avoid costly retrials and to avoid situations where counsel has a perverse incentive to test a verdict, to sit on objections only to raise them through a new trial. And what we would submit is that...
Well, he didn't use the magic words, but trial counsel can say, Your Honor, I'd like to have a standing objection to the admission of this evidence of prior drug use.
Your Honor, what I would say, and I think if I'm misunderstanding you, please correct me, but getting to the motion in limine orders, and I know that's been a focus of the discussion today. On the order related to references to Ms. Seyfried's drug use, That order did deny the motion in limine. It said it was relevant. It said it was relevant to multiple issues. As Judge Branch pointed out, it was relevant to the causation issues and why the surgeons at U.S. Now, Shands.
The concern in this case is not that it was relevant. I guess it was relevant, but whether or not it was a violation of Rule 403, that it was prejudicial nature of it. I don't need any probative value it had, because it seems like during the course of the trial, what the defendants in this case kept arguing that this was a drug addict, ladies and gentlemen. And so her real argument is that the jail was deliberately indifferent to my medical needs because they were biased against drug addicts. And they just, that was the focus of the trial. She's a drug addict. And that's why you should rule against her on her deliberate indifference claim. And if that's the case, that seems, there's a difference between saying she died because she was on drugs at the time that she was brought into the jail. There's a difference between that and she's a drug addict.
I understand.
That evidence, to me, seems prejudicial.
And I apologize for interrupting you there, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. It's relevant on the defense side in terms of that ultimate causation issue, because what the surgeons at UF Shands found was that there was evidence of continued drug use, and in that situation, they're not going to provide surgical intervention, which would have been a new heart valve. It was the plaintiffs that their theory of the case was that the appellees were biased against her because they labeled her drug-seeking, because they considered her a drug user. That was the plaintiff's theory of the case, but I think getting to the core evidentiary issue in terms of whether the motion in limine preserved that issue and didn't require contemporaneous objection during the trial, the order denying the motion in limine said, in a footnote, it said that the court will entertain objections to cumulative evidence, to evidence that's deemed prejudicial. It's relevant, but if it becomes a feature of the case, I'm going to consider it. And trial counsel made that strategic decision to not bring it to the court's attention. And this record, we don't even have an exercise of discretion to determine if it's been abused or not. And what I'll say, and I want to make a comment too about the motion in limine as directed towards the circumstances of Ms. Seyfried's arrest, because there was some notion that, you know, that motion in limine, right, of course, was granted. Well, it was granted as to the omission of the arrest report. But what we assert and what we argue here today, and that type of argument wasn't even made in the initial brief, that was sufficient to preserve the objection. And Judge Schoflat, I agree with your observation that motion in limine rulings are tentative. They're routinely renewed at trial, but if you look at the commentary and the advisory committee notes to Rule 103, and I'm gonna look down and read what it says. It says, if the court changes its initial ruling, or if the opposing party violates the terms of the initial ruling on a motion in limine, objection must be made when the evidence is offered to preserve the claim of error for appeal. The error in any such situation occurs only when the evidence is offered and admitted. And that was a proposition that was affirmed by this court in ML Healthcare Services v. Public Supermarkets, 881 F3rd, 1293. So Judge Schoflat, you're exactly right. You obtain a tentative ruling on an evidentiary issue through a motion in limine.
Well, and this, it's expressly a provision on a case like this in which drugs are throughout the case. From before the arrest, as I understand it, the first valve operation was open heart surgery, was it not?
That's my understanding, Your Honor, okay. Yes.
Her vessels would not take a valve operation once she died, where they put the valve in through the vessels, because the vessels were gone, so they had to do another open heart surgery.
That's my understanding, Your Honor,
yes. I could not imagine that at some point in time, drugs use and everything else, and she showed the physical signs of drugs, as I understand it, on her body.
Yes, Your Honor, it was noted.
So it's going to creep into the case. That's why I say, in my view, that this in limine ruling was absolutely provisional.
Your Honor, I agree with everything you just said. There was evidence presented that the surgeons at the University of Florida in Gainesville had noted that there was evidence of continued drug use. That was in our experts' report. And what the trial judge said is, look, I think this is relevant. It's relevant to causation issues. The plaintiff herself has proffered this theory of the case where she says that she was labeled drug-seeking, and that was because there was a bias against Ms. Seyfried because she was a drug user, and that means the appellees declined to provide medical care for me in deliberate indifference to my constitutional rights. So this has been a feature of the case that has been made by the plaintiff herself. It was part of her theory of the case. We've cited in our papers, and I'm not going to belabor the court with the specific sites, but we've cited in our paper record sites where the plaintiff herself is bringing this information before the court to make an argument that, you know, this is our theory, this is how we think we should prevail and why we think there was some bias that resulted in this deliberate indifference. But I absolutely would submit to this court that it is provisional, and there's nothing more clear of the fact that the ruling was not definite and was not encompassed within the understanding of 103B than that footnote, which says, I'm ruling on this now because I think it's relevant based on how y'all have brought this case to me in the pretrial papers and how it's been briefed. But object again. If it becomes an issue at trial, lodge an objection, lodge a contemporaneous objection, and I'll rule on it then. And we submit, the appellees submit, that this case, and this appeal, I should say, is the attempt by the plaintiff's lawyers to relitigate these strategy decisions and relitigate a decision not to make a contemporaneous objection. And I, as I've said, there's perverse incentives to a ruling that really countenances that type of behavior. You know, had there been an objection made, my friend on the other side referenced a statement made in the opening statement that he found objectionable. Well, stand up. You make a contemporaneous objection, you move for a mistrial, parties could have recessed and a new jury could have been picked if it was deemed so prejudicial and so biasing, right, to the jury to constitute a need for a new trial. And that could have conserved an incredible amount of resources. So a ruling that says you don't have to satisfy your obligations under the contemporaneous objection rule, really, and cases of this court have said it, kind of fly in the face of those core purposes of bringing these issues before the trial judge to exercise discretion upon which this court, right, can determine whether or not there's been an abuse of that discretion. And second, it prevents counsel from sitting on an objection, testing a verdict, and sandbagging the other side with the motion for a new trial on unpreserved issues. And we'd submit that really the vast majority, nearly all of the issues that are pressed in this case, the evidentiary issues, were simply not preserved by contemporaneous objection. I'm happy to answer any other questions that the panel has. I can go through each of the different categories of evidence that they believe constitutes an abuse of discretion.
As I understand it, bias, they didn't do anything because she's an addict, was in the case.
Your Honor, it's my understanding that that was the plaintiff's theory of the case.
Mr. Butler can tell us how you could keep out of evidence any history of drug use.
Yeah, Your Honor.
If that was the reason why they didn't act.
And Your Honor, what I would say too is my view of the case and putting myself in the place of, well, what if I was the plaintiff's lawyer? What kind of case would I try? I would maybe want that evidence related to the circumstances of the arrest into the record. If my argument is they labeled her as a drug user, they labeled her as an addict, they didn't want to give her medical care because they had this bias against her, I think that would only support.
Well, there are cases, lots of cases, in which you have an alcoholic or you have a drug addict or something in jail, and they know it and they ignore it. And that becomes indifference under the Eighth Amendment.
Sure, absolutely. I'm not. I wouldn't be surprised that there were such cases, and they proceeded on that theory. They presented that evidence, and the jury.
Of course, this wasn't an Eighth Amendment case, so.
14th Amendment, correct, Your Honor.
I'm just different.
Well, Your Honor, my understanding.
It was Eighth Amendment away, yes.
Correct. You know, and Your Honor, what I would say, Judge Schoflat, is that that was a theory that they tested. That was a theory they submitted to the jury. The jury didn't find for the plaintiff in this case. The jury found that Sergeant Googe wasn't even aware of the serious medical need that Ms. Seyfried had. And I think that that's worth pointing out, too. The jury found that she had a serious medical need. And I don't think, you know, the Constitution is blind, right, to why the serious medical need is there in the first place. It's blind to what the condition is that leads to the source of the deliberate indifference. But what we think that would be really anathema to this court's precedent and to the contemporaneous objection rule is to say, is to countenance basically what my friend on the other side, the plaintiffs, are asking here in this case, which is, go to court, go to trial, try a case based on a theory where you're proceeding, much like you're describing, Judge Schoflat, where you're saying there's evidence of this bias. Sit on objections to the introduction of evidence that the trial court has explicitly advised you in an order on a motion in limine and said, if this becomes cumulative, if this becomes prejudice, renew your objection and I'll consider it at trial, much in the way of that, the provisional explanation that you've been referring to, Judge Schoflat. Not do that and then move for a new trial after a verdict has been reached. That's testing the verdict, and it's completely out of step with the contemporaneous objection rule and finds no support in any aspect of Rule 103. I know I've already described the advisory committee notes and those notes that speak to exactly what Judge Schoflat, you're saying, which is if an order of motion of limine is violated, if a judge violates it, if a party violates it, you've got an obligation then to get up, stand on your objection, and bring it to the court's attention. And I think it's really telling what we've heard today, which is, well, objecting is a strategy decision. It is a strategy decision, but it's required to preserve error before this court. And to the extent the trial court even got a chance to exercise discretion, I don't think that any precedent in this case, in this court's cases or in certainly not in the papers, would support that discretion was abused at all in leaving the jury's verdict undisturbed. Therefore, we'd ask for affirmance in all respects. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Slanker. And Mr. Butler, you've reserved some time.
Thank you, Your Honor. A motion in limine is also a strategy decision. And from if a definitive ruling on a motion in limine is not an enforceable order that has any force or teeth,
Mr. Butler, don't take my dialogue with counsel too far. You can have a motion in limine. Say there's a document that a party wants to introduce and the other party wants to keep it out. And whether or not it can come in or out is obvious. So the court says, oh, I deny the motion, or I grant the motion. That's easy to preserve that. But this is a case in which the trial, the drugs that permeates this case from beginning to end, the realistic it does. And you want to try it so it doesn't.
The circumstances of the arrest, Your Honor, the circumstances of the arrest, the active ongoing drug use that comes.
Well, doesn't the jailer know why she was arrested?
I suppose the jailer did know. I suppose the jailer would know.
She had a preliminary hearing or an initial appearance, and they granted bail. But she couldn't post her bond.
And she couldn't post her bond. But she knew that she, let me say, Nurse Starr knew or probably knew that she had somebody who was in jail on arrest.
She had a drug addict on hands.
She had a drug addict, but she had no evidence of drug seeking. I mean, the thing was, it looked like you mentioned before, said it looked like she was an active drug user, but she had all of the symptoms were symptoms of endocarditis. The symptoms that she was manifesting in jail.
But drug addicts manifest all kinds of symptoms. We can take judicial notice of that just about.
This one had a heart card. This one had a heart card, and she had an open chest surgery scar, and she was complaining of chest pain. She had nausea. The where they got the drug seeking, the only place they sort of had some area of saying, oh, she's being dishonest about what she's doing, she said, I haven't been able to eat. And she said, oh, well, if you haven't been able to eat, she's hurting, I haven't been able to eat. She said, if you haven't been able to eat, then you can't have anything for your pain. You can't have any meds. Well, she says, well, I did eat, but I've been nauseated and I was throwing up. She said, well, if you're nauseated and you're throwing up, you can't have any meds. And so it's there. She's begging for help. And that bit there, they used and held on to that and says, okay, drug seeking all the way across the top. While she's not drug seeking, she's dying of endocarditis. She needed to go to the hospital. My concern, though, is about where, if we're going to say that a motion in limine, look, the violation of the motion in limine up at the beginning of the opening argument was so blatant, so brazen, that the question is whether should trial counsel have moved, or should trial counsel should have objected, or should trial counsel have moved for contempt? I mean, it was that brazen. And if a motion in limine is not going to have any more force than that, if it's not going to have any more, if especially a definitive, conclusive motion in limine that says you will not bring in evidence of the pretrial. You will not bring in evidence of the circumstances of the arrest. If that's the case, then really there's no point to be making motions in limine. Because when you make a motion in limine, what you're doing is you're showing the other side your hand. You're showing the other side your hand, and you're inviting them to violate it in their hopes that they'll get the evidence in, even though the court said it's not admissible. I mean, it really says don't make motions in limine if we are going to not let them have any teeth whatsoever. And that's what I feel like is being said right here, is that the contemporaneous objection. I understand when you're saying contemporaneous objection, give the trial court opportunity to fix it. But when it's a definitive, conclusive, clearly stated motion in limine that these matters are not going to come in, and they do it anyway, they do it again and again and again with not every witness, but very nearly every witness, they said, did you know that she was arrested for drug use? Regardless of whether they knew or not. So, anyway, Your Honor, that's where we are, and I think I've pretty well said what my position is on this. And
we have your argument, Mr. Butler. Thank
you,
sir. We have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slanker. Next case is Christopher.